2007, the last show of 2007, and less than a week away from the Iowa caucuses and the full onslaught of presidential politics in 2008 in the United States. It's going to be the subject of our show today, and our guest is going to be one of the best possible guests we could have, one of the leading political journalists in the country, John Nichols, joining us for the full hour today on Media Matters. But first, before we go to John Nichols and talk about media and politics, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
Do you vomit when you open the paper? Are you sick from what the prophet's gonna say? Are you paralyzed by the ministry's lies? It'd be nice to get some real news today.
The Harry Potter Alliance, an organization dedicated to fighting the dark arts in the real world, has teamed up with the StopBigMedia.com coalition to mobilize Harry Potter fans against media consolidation.
Now, this bill has united people from every house, liberals and conservatives, Democrats and Republicans. It's not about what party you belong to. It's about supporting what Harry and the Order did not have, the right to a free press.
Slack parallels the problems that Harry Potter faces with issues in the real world. He asks his listeners to think about what they care about most in the series.
Perhaps you care most about waking up the world to Voldemort's return. In other words, waking our world to human rights violations like the genocides in Darfur, Burma, and places like Uganda and Congo, or other issues not being properly addressed like local and global poverty or local and global AIDS. Perhaps it's the real world equivalent to international cooperation of the wizarding world. You know, creating a Department of Peace.
Slack goes on to name workers' rights, environmentalism, racial equality, gay rights, prison reform, and habeas corpus as other important stories in the Potter series that are rarely addressed in the media today.
But if you have a number one issue, an issue that makes you fired up and ready to do something, whatever your number one issue is, media reform should be your number two issue.
The campaign's Potter Watch website features a compilation of Wizard Rock songs about the dangers of Voldemedia.
Fight! Fight! We've got to! Fight! Fight! For the truth! Fight! Fight! For integrity! Fight! Fight! Handstand is one!
To listen to the Potter Watch podcast and to download the songs for free, go to stopbigmedia.com/potterwatch.
As 2007 winds down and the new year begins, Media Minutes takes a look back at some of the media activists who have made a difference. Lauren Glenn Davidian is the executive director of CCTV's Center for Media and Democracy in Vermont. Involved in community media for more than 20 years, she recently won the George Stoney Award for Humanistic Communications, presented by the Alliance for Community Media. Davidian first got involved in community media as a young college student. Trained as an anthropologist, she wanted to use some public access equipment to document people's stories in Burlington, Vermont. When the cable company escorted her to a closet filled with old, broken-down equipment, Davidian changed her career path.
And I said, well, that's not going to work, so I'll be back. And essentially turned very quickly from a video maker, documentary maker, to a community organizer. Once I explained what public access TV was, it didn't take people long to say, that's what I want to do.
The internet, she says, is no replacement for public access television.
We can't even say community media is less significant than it's been in the past. It's actually more significant because it's actual real estate that the public controls and uses. And we have to keep fighting for it.
And the fight is on. Several states have passed video franchise legislation threatening the viability of public access. Cable and phone companies are pushing for laws that absolve them from their public interest obligations. Davidian is undeterred. She says, it's not easy work, but we need to keep our foot in the door.
The highest and best use of free speech is to be able to mobilize change to create communities that we want to live in. we have to have a set aside. We have to claim a portion of the public property that commercial interests use, whether they're a phone company or a cable company or a satellite company. They're using either public airwaves, public spectrum, or public rights of way to generate profits. And that's public, and it belongs to us.
Davidian says the only way to create diversity in media is through diversity in ownership.
What we really want is as many different kinds of people and entities owning the media as possible. And right now, when it's in the hands of a few companies that are global in nature, you don't have diversity. We have to have a place for people that don't have commercial interests to say what they need to say.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today on WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Our guest today is someone who needs no introduction to Media Matters listeners, but he's usually with me when we've got the tin cup out trying to raise money for public radio and for Media Matters. He is, of course, John Nichols, the Washington correspondent and editor for The Nation magazine, editorial page editor for the Capital Times up in Madison, Wisconsin, and author of many books, including the highly acclaimed Genius of Impeachment, which has been out now for, how long has it been, a year?
About a year. And although it's sort of the author's dream, it's a book that came out and did fine initially, and then we did Bill Moyers' show.
Mm-hmm.
And which is very relevant to a show like Media Matters because it tells us something powerful.
That if media covers an issue, it can make...
It can have a huge impact.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
We did Bruce Fine and I did Bill Moyers' show in July. And since then, the book and really the issue of impeachment has gone to a whole other place. And I have to be honest with you, I cover politics for a living. So there's a big part of me that was sort of ready to flip over to covering the presidential race. But what's been so striking is because of that Moyers appearance, people around the country, they're not willing to let me. And that's a wonderful thing. They took more seriously, maybe even than I did, the importance of holding the Bush administration to account. And so continue to do speaking. In fact, I'll be in New Hampshire 2 days before the primary at a big event in Keene, New Hampshire, to talk about impeachment and how we connect presidential accountability to this presidential race. And I love that people are thinking in this creative way. I wish our media did a little of that.
Well, you know, it is striking to me that in the Clinton era, impeachment was very quickly an issue on the table, taken very seriously.
Oh, yeah.
And became a dominant issue. And, you know, I'm just looking objectively at the sort of the factual basis for concerns about violations of the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't really think the Clinton transgressions were noticeably more severe than what was being outlined today.
I wouldn't have said this couple of years ago, but in fact, actually, the funny thing is that writing about impeachment was something that developed out of our relationship. It was on a book tour that you and I were doing for our book Tragedy and Farce, and I had so many people bringing up impeachment that I decided to delve into it. And so I give that background to say that as somebody who thinks of myself as something of an expert on impeachment, I can tell you that it is very possible that Clinton committed impeachable offenses. And I like to have a very, very low bar. I think that we should be able to impeach presidents very easily. But the fact of the matter is, to compare Clinton's offenses, even at their very, very worst, to Bush's offenses, in the best interpretation, it's not even the same ballpark.
The circle still don't intersect.
Not at all. I mean, Clinton's sins were the sins of a weak man. Of a man, and I'm not talking about the sex, I'm talking about in general campaign fundraising, the whole array of wrongs that Bill Clinton committed were those of a weak man. Bush's sins are not those of a weak man. They are of an arrogant country. I've been toying with the term isolationist imperialism, and it is that the Bush administration has a totally American-centric, American-focused policy toward the world, but it's also imperialistic. And so unlike even some previous figures like Ronald Reagan, who still sort of erred on the side of coming home, Bush errs on the side of making his mistakes outwardly. And it's very, very dangerous. Letting him continue as president for another year is a very risky move. And I think he probably will continue. I'm not saying he'll be impeached because I don't think the Democrats have the guts to do it. But I will say that he is basically the textbook example for a president who should be removed.
No, and I we've had you on the show a year ago when Genius of Impeachment came out, mm-hmm. and I had the privilege of reading the book, and I think you make the case as powerfully in there that if we're serious about having impeachment in the Constitution, this is exactly what the founders had in mind.
Yeah, if we don't do it now, we might as well knock it out.
Well, yeah, let's get rid of it, just so we don't pretend to.
And here's an interesting thing, that because we're going to talk about the presidential race, which we should, and we're right on the eve of it, but the interesting thing is that one of the great impeachments in history, that of Andrew Johnson, in 1868, and a very appropriate impeachment, he was a terrible president, mm-hmm. Played out in the weeks before the Republican National Convention of 1868. It was actually playing out as the Republican Party was preparing to nominate a replacement for Andrew Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
And the person who was backing that impeachment was Ulysses Grant,
the
man
the Republican
who
nomination.
Was nominated and who was Johnson's Secretary of Defense. I mean, it was, or Secretary of the Army at that point.
Yeah.
The bottom line was that historically people fully understood that you could walk and chew gum at the same time. You could hold a lousy president to account to make sure you cleanse the office of its sins while electing a new president. Unfortunately, I think what's changed in America is not the Constitution, certainly, and I'm not even sure it's Congress, although our political class is very different. I think what's really changed is our media. I think our media now views a presidential election year as sacrosanct. Nothing else can happen. You cannot govern. You cannot do any other, you know, official activity. You know, Bush, they asked Bush in, I think it was People Magazine. He did an interview with mm-hmm. People Magazine this week.
He really stepped out.
I know, it was a bold, challenging interview.
I guess O'Reilly was tied up.
Yeah, no, well, O'Reilly would have been tough. No, compared to People. People was like questions like, you know, I swear one of the questions was to Laura Bush, said one of the people who's sent a question in for us to ask you is a former employee at Camp David who said you always smelled so nice. I'm not kidding. So this is that kind of interview. But they asked Bush what he's looking forward to doing in 2008. And I swear, this is Bush's answer. He said, I'm looking forward to going to the Olympics in Beijing.
Well,
that was it. You know, not healthcare, dealing with the economy, maybe yeah. ending a horrible war or two. No, it was, I'm looking forward to going to the Olympics. And that's the truth. Bush actually understands better than most of us his role. Mm. His role is basically stay out of the way, you know, go and do show appearances at the mm-hmm. Olympics where he shouldn't even go anyway, and continue the neoconservative experiment quietly in the way they always wanted to do it.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't want all the press coverage that they've mm-hmm. gotten. They want to do this quietly. And frankly, I think 2008 is going to be a dream year for George Bush, a wonderful year, because the media will be so obsessed with the theater of a presidential race,
mm-hmm.
and he will, frankly, have a year, even from now, mm-hmm. a year and a month, almost, yep. to really tie knots up, dot I's, cross his T's. I think this will be a good year, probably his favorite year as president.
Our guest today on Media Matters, John Nichols. You've been listening to the reporter, author, editor for The Nation magazine, The Capital Times, up in Madison, Wisconsin, and also author of many books, a few with myself, I'm proud to say, but especially the recent book, The Genius of Impeachment. We've been talking about impeachment. We're also going to be talking about presidential politics in 2008, media coverage of it, and the upcoming Iowa caucuses and New Hampshire primary. John Nichols has been covering this beat as closely as anyone for the last, well, permanently. I mean, you've been covering the political beat for 20 years.
I always cover presidential politics. And, you know, the fact is that I remember at the 2004 convention in New York City where Bush was renominated, I remember, you know, interviewing people at that convention about the 2008 race. The fact is we do, and I criticize it, but I'm also a part of it. We have a permanent campaign in this country.
Yeah.
The campaign never stops. People are always positioning. But now it's kind of like we have permanent Christmas in this country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they start selling things at Halloween for Christmas. Well, now we're finally to Christmas Eve. We are almost at the Iowa caucuses, which, perversely enough, are probably the most undemocratic way to start a selection of a leader of a country outside of the old Politburo, you know, the sessions in the hallways of the Politburo in the Soviet Union or the Chinese Communist Congress. Because, do you understand, on Thursday in Iowa, they will have caucuses. Apparently, it looks like it's going to be about 10 below zero. Unbelievably cold.
Is it Thursday or Saturday?
That's Thursday.
It is Thursday.
This coming Thursday.
The third. Okay.
It will be Thursday the 3rd.
So we're only 5 days off, or a handful of days off.
Yeah, we got New Year's in between. I mean, it's like it's absurdity, and we got like a bunch of football games to watch.
And then 12 days after that comes New Hampshire.
No, Bob.
5 days.
It's literally Thursday night. Caucuses last in Iowa. We can walk our way all the way through this, but caucuses will occur Thursday in Iowa. They are 2 to 3 hour affairs. Mm-hmm. They're very long events. Actually, once you're in it, it's a pretty good thing. You know, it's very there's a lot of communication and debate and stuff, but the caucuses won't actually end perhaps till midnight, some of them, or at least 10 o'clock at night, something like that. They will be voting in New Hampshire. That's midnight on starting Friday morning. They will start voting in New Hampshire at 12:01 up in Dixville Notch, New Hampshire, on Tuesday morning. Mm-hmm. So I was calculating this out. There's less than 100 hours between when they finish in Iowa and they start in New Hampshire. And this is a media issue here, because historically Iowa was at least 7 or 8 days before. Mm-hmm. That gave you a whole weekend cycle in between. So candidates could, you know, they could talk, they could go on Meet the Press, they do all this stuff like that. Here's what's going to happen in Iowa. They will get the results Friday morning. Those will be on the front page of every paper in the country. It'll be the dominant news story on Friday.
Oh, yeah, cable news will go nuts.
But newspapers put themselves to bed for Sunday. The Sunday editions go to bed on Friday. And so you realize that the whole of this story will be locked in at its surface level. The week of analysis, the week of discussion that we historically would have had, which might tweak it apart and say, oh, yeah, well, but did you notice this? Hillary Clinton did really badly among these voters. Or this. That's all going to be lost. And we are going to literally lock in an impression, first impression from Iowa, which may be, let's say Hillary Clinton gets 29%, Barack Obama gets 27%. The headline is Hillary beats Obama, front runner, the whole bit, that front, and then you're suddenly in New Hampshire.
You know, and the absurdity of this is, I think you were alluding to before we got off on this last point, was simply that the percentage of voters, Democrat and Republican, on each side who participate in these caucuses is quite low.
6%.
Iowa is a small state to begin
with. It's a tiny state with a handful of electoral votes, right? It's a great place. I like Iowa a lot.
No, I do too.
But only 6% of Iowans participate in the caucuses. That means if you're with 100 people, 94 of them won't be a part of it.
And it means that if 29 to 27% or 29 to 23%,
you might be talking a few hundred.
Yeah, to talk about this being some sort of significant breakthrough in the American population is patently absurd.
It's not. And here's another thing you got to throw off. That 6% is disproportionately elderly women, who I love. And Bob, you and I know as people who are...
Yeah, they buy all our books.
They're the backbone of good citizenship.
They're listening to the show right now, and we love you.
They are good citizens. No, they are. But I'm talking... Do you know that if you look at the age level in the caucuses, you're getting into the 80s for a lot of these caucuses. They're older folks, and they're predominantly women, mainly retired women. I went to a caucus in Dubuque 4 years ago, and it blew my mind. It was in a senior center, and a lot of them, caucuses can be held anywhere. You can be in a basement of a union hall. It can be in a town hall.
Schools.
It can be wherever, in a home. Many of them are in homes.
I've been in home caucuses.
In rec rooms,
I've been in several caucuses.
Out in Washington State, sure. But I went to this one in the senior home, which was a retirement center for nuns. So there I am. I'm sitting in the middle. This is choosing the next president of the United States with about 80 retired nuns. And they're tough. I mean, they were rough. And they were divided mainly between the Kucinich camp and the Kerry camp. Mm-hmm. Kerry, this is how seriously Kerry took this. Kerry had come and gotten communion with the nuns, right? But this is, it's a tiny group of people, a very self-selected group. Frankly, super citizens, I have nothing against them. But the notion that the next president of the United States will be selected by, you know, a handful of folks who skew disproportionately toward certain demographics there's nothing democratic about it. We should do away with caucuses.
The rest of the states aren't going to put up with this any longer, are they? I mean, my sense is that it's going to...
Maybe we say that every 4 years. Look, I've got a cover story coming out in The Nation this coming, the day of Iowa, It will parallel with the caucuses. And it is on the crisis of the current model for selecting a president. And what I argue is that because conventions in the summer have become such a joke, they're just theater. There's nothing real that happens at conventions anymore. They just, it's 4 days of putting the candidate up before the people. Because they've become a joke, the parties in the states have figured out that they don't need to follow the rules of the national party. So now they started saying, well, the thing that's really powerful is being an early caucus or primary. So now you've had this front loading where they've all pushed forward.
Yeah.
And we are literally, do you know that when people are voting in New Hampshire, they'll also be voting in California? Because the California primary has been moved so far forward, and they have early voting. So people will actually be going to vote in early January in California as well.
And they're technically on February 5th.
They are February 5th. Yeah. That's what I'm saying. It's just, so the whole thing has become a cacophony. Many people don't even know their state is going to be holding a primary.
Yeah.
The candidates don't even know where to go.
Illinois is February 5th.
February 5th, yeah.
Okay.
The candidates don't even know where to go. And it's really skewed the whole process nationally.
Now, John, my sense is that with all the money, I mean, I've looked at the campaign numbers for both the Republicans and Democrats, and the Democrats are raising more than the Republicans by a wide margin.
Overwhelmingly, and that's
a sign that the big money thinks they're going to win.
It's capitalism views power. There was one honest statement made, you know, about 10 years ago, a guy was brought in. He was testifying on campaign finance reform before a Senate committee. He'd been indicted for something. And they said, well, do you vote? And he said, no, why would I vote? I give money, you know, and I mean, the fact is that capital realized a long time ago that their job is not to give a fortune to elect the person they want. It is to bet on the person who's likely to win early enough that person's going to listen to you. And of course, there's some people who wouldn't, you know, Dennis Kucinich, capital could probably give him $1 billion and he still wouldn't listen. But the fact is that Wall Street, the hedge fund folks, all the corporate types, they recognized Hillary Clinton as somebody they could work with. And Fortune magazine had a wonderful cover story last summer. It's little talked about beyond the zones of the business camp. But it said, you know, why Wall Street loves Hillary Clinton.
Yeah. I don't think Barack Obama necessarily seems to be angering too many either.
Oh, he's horrible. Look, the fact of the matter is Clinton and Obama are terrific players on a host of social issues, in my view. I think they'll actually be relatively liberal, and I don't think it's not to attack them as a whole, but we have to be honest with ourselves about where they relate to corporate power in this country. And the fact is that Clinton and Obama are indistinguishable. They are both absolutely committed to maintaining the neoliberal experiment as operating under Bush. They won't do radically different things. Mm-hmm. They may have a warmer heart. And so, you know, at some point they may steer a few extra bucks over toward a children's health program or something like that. I really believe that's true. I don't doubt that. But in the overall scheme of changing the system, the closest you get among the leading candidates is John Edwards. John Edwards has done an interesting thing. He has moved toward what is now the most aggressive corporate critique of a major presidential candidate. Candidate since Jesse Jackson in 1988.
Yeah, I think that's right.
He has.
And he really has, from what I can see, ramped up the critique dramatically from 4 years ago.
Yeah. 4 months ago.
That's right.
I mean, the fact is the last Democratic presidential debate in Iowa was an epic debate. And in fact, Edwards literally restarted his candidacy in one debate. And everybody who watched it in Iowa, it was done by the Des Moines Register, agreed. There was universal agreement that Edwards had won. That was a given. But the critical thing was why he won. He went to a deep, powerful place as regards factory closings. He spent a lot of time in Iowa, so he spoke specifically about people and towns. And he linked it to a corporate critique in a way, frankly, that Jackson in 88 did very, very well. Ralph Nader in 2000 did a little bit of, and sometimes was pretty good at it. But you don't hear that often on the stage with all the major candidates.
Yeah.
And when Edwards did that, he helped himself. Not only is he now in clear competition in Iowa, it's a three-way tie. Thursday night's going to be interesting, at the least. We'll have somebody's going to win this, and we don't know who. And then he also has brought himself back into competition in New Hampshire, which is stunning. At one point in New Hampshire, he was down to 9%. He was really in bad shape. Bill Richardson was about to pass him up. Now he's up to 18, 20%. He's clearly moving. He's drawing percentages off the other candidates. I don't think he's going to win New Hampshire, but I think John Edwards is viable with a corporate critique. And he's an imperfect player. But it's very interesting to watch what he's done message-wise.
Our guest today on Media Matters is John Nichols, who you've just been listening to. I'm Bob McChesney, your host here in WILL AM 580. This is a live show coming to you, so please do feel free to call in if you have any questions or comments for John Nichols, 333-9455, and our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Now, the thing, John, about these caucuses work is that it's not like people just come in and vote. I mean, you caucus, so... I mean, this is where it sort of gets interesting. It's sort of like a game of Risk or something.
It is.
Where if you come in and your candidate, who you really feel strongly about, is doing very poorly, you shift your vote and you calculate which other candidates.
And people beg you to come over and you calculate who you might hurt or help. And candidates actually send. This is the power of the digital age. And it's also the weakness of the digital age. In the old days, people came in committed. Mm-hmm. Sometimes if your candidate didn't do well, if you came in as an anti-nuclear activist in 1984, your candidate didn't do well, you just left, mm-hmm. right? You know, you went to somebody you liked personally. Weirdly enough, in 1984 in the Iowa caucuses, the candidate who blew everybody away and did better than anyone expected was George McGovern. Mm-hmm. And what happened was there were a lot of weaker candidates like Alan Cranston and others. And when they got into the caucuses, they all just decided, oh, okay, well, my guy's not doing so well, I'll shift over to McGovern. And McGovern got a very good finish there. But here, the best way to understand a caucus is to use the figure of 100. Let's say 100 people show up. Now, to get registered as a vote coming out of your caucus, you know, something that's going to be tallied, you have to get 15%. So 15% of 100, you have to have 15 people behind your candidate. Let's say only 12 show up for your candidate. You got to do one of two things. Either you got to find three other people from somebody else, or your 12 got to link up with another candidate. And I've seen it happen. It's a fascinating thing. It definitely benefits not the newcomer, but the sophisticated partisan, somebody who's been there a lot. Like I was at this caucus of Dubuque 4 years ago. The Kerry people dominated. They had probably, of the, say, 100 people, they had like 65. Mm-hmm. The Kucinich people only had 7 or 8. But they were led by an elderly nun who'd gone to federal prison to protest the School of the Americas. Mm-hmm. This was a tough, smart woman who'd done a lot of politics. She saw she didn't have her numbers. She went immediately to the Edwards people because that morning the Kucinich campaign had by email communicated to all of its caucus coordinators, if you don't have enough to caucus on your own, caucus with the Edwards people, because mm-hmm. they viewed Edwards as the most sympathetic, and also Dennis Kucinich liked Elizabeth Edwards. It was as simple as that. And so the end result was that those Kucinich people all went over to Edwards, and she did it instantaneously, and she got some of the Dean people to come over. And but there's this horse trading. It can take hours.
John, let me run this idea by you. I think until at least a couple weeks ago, the wisdom, and I don't know if it was conventional or not, because it might have been better than that, was that Hillary is the front runner and that Obama and Edwards were both to her left. They were more liberal and progressive. And is Hillary was benefiting as long as the two of them were carving up the same slice of the pie. And so it's in her interest to keep both of them alive and weak rather than have one of them drop out and have one strong anti-Hillary in the race. Do you think that analysis still holds, or has now Obama positioned himself so more toward of a mainstream candidate
moved radically to the center. I mean, Barack Obama hasn't said anything of consequence now for 2 months. I mean, his statements have just been vapid beyond belief. But here's the interesting thing. I mean, people do, for a variety of reasons, invest Obama with a great deal of emotion. And also, he has a pretty good track record. I mean, he did oppose the damn war, you know, back in 2002. So, you know what I mean? So there's things, even though his rhetoric is pretty weak at this point compared to Edwards, who's very muscular. And actually, Hillary, who's more muscular than Obama. Obama has moved into front position. He actually got a lead in Iowa and in some polls in New Hampshire. I think Obama suffers from a really bad, it's a dangerous situation. He may have peaked 2 weeks too soon. You want to come into Iowa with momentum, not with, you know, being locked in. And so he's, I think, lost a little bit of his stature. But I will tell you this. This is the truth. There's no question whatsoever that people coming to these caucuses will do different things. If Hillary Clinton is running weaker, and it looks like Obama's going to win, Hillary people, if they don't have the right percentages, will be told to caucus with Edwards people. Because they'd rather have Edwards come out than Obama start a real
momentum thing.
Momentum.
Keep Edwards alive.
Whereas
basically.
Richardson, and Bill Richardson has a pretty good campaign in Iowa, Richardson people will definitely caucus with Clinton rather than with Edwards, because they know if Edwards comes out strong, Richardson becomes irrelevant.
Yeah.
So you're going to see, this is an arcane process, mm-hmm. and you're going to see draconian, complex calculus in
play. Sort of seems like European politics in 1912 or something, you know, with all these alliances. And
or a poker game,
yeah.
right? You're who do you judge, who blinks? And again, the problem is with this is it dramatically benefits the veteran political insider. People have this fantasy that the Iowa caucuses are somehow democracy embodied. In fact, the Iowa caucuses come very close to a return to the smoke-filled room.
Our guest, John Nichols. Let's go to the phone lines now here on Media Matters, WILL AM 580, our home station. Let's go to line one, Champaign. You're on the air with John Nichols.
Hi there. How are you?
Hello.
Very good. Thank you.
Just a couple comments. First of all, usually I'm pretty activated when it comes to presidential elections, but the amount of money that's just been spent on the primaries alone, and as much as I think Hillary might make a decent president, I'm not sure, given that she'd probably get two terms, that I want two families in charge of the White House for 28 years. And I'm just wondering if the apathy that I'm starting to form in my own head is typical. And I guess the other thing I'm asking is what it does, and I probably know the answer, but, you know, the right-wing religious conservatives are not really too vocal yet, but I know they're out there, and I'm just wondering if I turn apathetic, again, how similar am I, and what happens if I can't be motivated to get more involved in this? And I'll hang up and listen to your answer.
Yeah, well, thank you very much, caller. Yeah, so
you gave us so much to work with there. I don't know where to begin.
Yeah, what's your take, John? Is apathy, are you experiencing that? Because you deal with people like myself who are political junkies all the time. That's your world. Mm-hmm. Is your sense that there's much electricity outside of the hardcore?
Well, no, because this thing has been so jammed. It's so front-loaded and so jammed into Iowa and New Hampshire that at this point, most people don't even know if they're in an early caucus state. Many people are, and they haven't seen the campaign come alive where they're at. So the number one, I think there is, I don't know that it's apathy. I think people are highly engaged. But I do think that it's, you know, they just haven't sorted it out yet. It's come mm-hmm. too fast, and it hasn't come in a logical or natural progression, you know, that sort of slow development of a process that you had even as recently as 1992 when Bill Clinton and Jerry Brown were fighting it out into May. And you got to think about it, and you had time. There isn't a lot of time. There is a lot of money, as this guy says, and it does seem like it's, you know, everything, aside from a few people in Iowa and New Hampshire, everything's happening far from you and in big money.
Well, no, what's scary to me, to follow up on the caller's point, is that, you know, after you get through Iowa, New Hampshire, and I guess Nevada and South Carolina, get to February 5th, which takes over
22 states, all voting at once.
At that point, it's all who has the most money to run these
ads.
It's
nothing but money.
It's all money.
The only reason we're doing Iowa and New Hampshire seriously, frankly, is to get that headline and the momentum and the free media.
Sort of tip off
Well, get the media to say you're going, right.
Tip off the hedge fund people where they should make their donations.
Make that final donation.
Yeah,
yeah. But it's also, no, there's another component here, and that relates to this show, is that the only thing that can counter the betting of the hedge fund managers and the Wall Street folks is an insurgent victory early on that gets a lot of media coverage, and then the free media of you won Iowa, you
sort
won
like
New Hampshire.
McGovern back in 72.
McGovern in 72, Jimmy Carter in 76.
Yeah.
Ronald Reagan in 1980, people forget Ronald Reagan was thought of as too old.
Yeah.
And then he started scoring, and he lost Iowa to mm-hmm. George Bush, but then he really started going. He won New Hampshire, one in the Carolinas, and then that. So historically, the free media can be a big factor, very, very important thing, and that's what they're all playing for.
Let's talk about, if we can, for a sec, the Republican side. Cause
our caller brought
that's
it up.
What I mean.
He said the religious rights seems to be motivated. No kidding. They are. Mm-hmm. In fact, you know, Mike Huckabee, this is the fascinating thing. You know, the Republican Party played for a long time in the field of the religious right, on the field of the committed Christian who didn't traditionally engage in politics, but they got them to engage. They taught them to vote. They taught mm-hmm. them to be politically engaged. And then they thought they could always turn them on and off. I thought they could turn him on and off. I was very cynical about this. Mike Huckabee wasn't. Mike Huckabee, the former governor of Arkansas, Baptist preacher, fundamentalist, he figured out something that a lot of people didn't, and that is that those people that they taught to vote now like to vote, and they want to vote, and they take it seriously. They see it as their franchise, as their operation. Mm-hmm. And so Huckabee offered them an alternative. And this guy has not pulled a punch the whole way. He has run as a, you know, a Bible-believing fundamentalist. He is so unbelievably visceral in some of what he says. I mean, what he has said about Mitt Romney and what his campaign has done to Mitt Romney in Iowa is truly a religious test. They have basically communicated to religious fundamentalists in Iowa, Mitt Romney, a Mormon, should not be the president.
Yeah.
And they've done the similar things to other people. They actually attacked Sam Brownback for converting to Catholicism, that he was no longer a Protestant fundamentalist.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so what this Huckabee campaign is religious fundamentalism in play. And here's the interesting thing. He probably will win Iowa. Not certainly.
Huckabee.
It's people are getting scared. And mm-hmm. so Romney's fighting his way back. He will not win New Hampshire. John McCain may win New Hampshire. McCain's had a real incredible rise, mm-hmm. driven by newspaper endorsements.
Mm-hmm.
He's won 25 newspaper endorsements in New Hampshire and the Boston area.
Mm-hmm.
They almost all are backing him, and it's helped him.
You would have thought Romney would do better in that area.
No, they know Romney. In fact, one of the newspapers, the Concord Monitor, had a big editorial in which they said, we don't care really who you vote for, but don't vote for Mitt Romney. But if you've got a split decision there, then you get into the South, South Carolina, places like that. The polling for Huckabee in a lot of southern states is stunning. I mean, he's getting
good.
Big numbers,
mm-hmm.
big numbers. And the Republican Party has a very serious problem. They will probably avert it. They will probably use those February 5th primaries and a lot of money to nominate someone other than Mike Huckabee.
And who do you think that would probably be?
It could well be. If I had to put money on somebody right now, I know this is an oddball thing, I'd bet McCain.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's on a huge rise. His polling numbers, he's now within a handful of points of Romney in New Hampshire. He's come up in Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
He is credible in a lot of places. He's going to get, in my view, that free media bump. And I think we haven't talked about this yet, but I believe, and I hate to, you know, it's a blunt way of saying it, I think there was a Benazir Bhutto primary. Came
mm-hmm.
before Iowa and New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact of the matter is that Hillary Clinton and John McCain, when Benazir Bhutto, the former prime minister of Pakistan, was assassinated, they both seemed very presidential. I think they both benefited a great deal by their response to it.
Our guest, John Nichols. You're listening to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're coming to you live today on WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Our phone number here, 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines right now to a caller who's been very patient. I hope we still have this caller.
Mm-hmm.
Line 2, Urbana, you're on the air with John Nichols.
Hello?
I think we might have lost.
Oh, well.
Oh, well. Line 2, thank you for your patience. Call back. We will get to you, and I apologize for
that. I think I'm here now.
Oh, you are? Okay. Good. I'm glad you made it through.
Yeah, great. Go ahead, Line 2.
Champaign County, which is located in lovely Urbana.
Okay.
I wanted to not necessarily eschew all the horse race here, but...
Please do. It's okay.
Get back to it in another way.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk about the duck in Crawford a little, and what do you make of him? The first thing is, how many times has the Senate gone into session in this pro forma way to prevent a recess appointment? And this pocket veto that he wants to do of the defense authorization bill that was, the
sine
qua non of anything happening, it's kind of blowing some people's minds around here. We don't know what he's doing. My limp suggestion was that they were so set on campaigning on the idea that the Democrats were not going to, support our troops with the money they need, that they wanted to find a way to put up, the reason was about these lawsuits against the former regime. Can you sort this out? Because I have I really don't know what's going on. And the way it gets back to the politics of it is the idea of how do the Democrats now run in the war when they themselves are believing that the surge is working.
Mm-hmm.
Juan Cole does a really nice job of demystifying, I think, on his Salon article and also on his website. If you would handle that for a while, thanks.
Sure.
Well, thank you very much for calling in. That's great.
Yeah, it's great stuff.
With.
The surge isn't working.
And, John, but maybe you could give some... I'm sorry, call. Yeah, goodbye. Thank you, Colin. John, maybe you could give some background on the first part of his question for listeners maybe not familiar with it, too.
Sure. First off, thanks, caller. You're asking all the right questions, and you're also doing something that citizens should be doing, and that is, you know, not merely paying attention to the presidential race. We should be paying very close attention to how the Bush administration is governing in this time. There's a couple important things to understand here. First off, the president has been playing so many games with congressional recesses that now the U.S. Senate does come into session essentially daily, with Jim Webb from Virginia coming up and sitting down and calling the Senate into session because they do not trust Bush not to use that recess period, not only to make appointments, that's the least of it, but also to issue executive orders, to do a host of things, claiming that because Congress is not in session, he can get away with it. So that's first step. That's a very, very important thing to understand, that there the conflict between the legislative and executive branch right now is more intense than it has been really at any time in history. Not that it's on issues. It's almost more personality-based. They really don't trust each other.
So the Dems aren't laying down as much as they're being accused of.
Well, they kind of are, because they're laying down, because this caller brings it up, the second part. They're passing the bills. Mm-hmm. They're basically giving Bush what he wants. Now, this bill, Bush is vetoing or doing a pocket veto on the defense bill because it had a minor provision in it that just simply said that people who are...
What's a pocket veto, John?
Oh, it just means you don't actually do a veto. You don't sign a... You don't
so it fades
officially
out, so.
Do it. You just, during a recess or during a time when Congress is not formally in session, you can let a period of time pass, and if you don't sign it, you've essentially vetoed it just because you didn't make it law. And but he issued a little statement saying the reason that he did this was because it had a provision in it that allowed lawsuits against the Iraqi government to remain open. Americans suing the Iraqi government seeking assets. And these are lawsuits rooted in the Saddam Hussein days, but that correctly, Bush is right about this. They could be a real problem for the current Iraqi government. Now, the absurdity of it, as the caller hit on, is this is the sort of thing that White House lobbyists sort out, right? I mean, this should never have been an issue. It's an absurdity that it is an issue, and Bush is playing a game. He's essentially saying to the Democrats, if you take this out, then I'll sign the bill. Now, they'll do that ultimately, although Frank Lautenberg, who is a good senator from New Jersey, is saying, why should we screw over Americans who have assets in Iraq, you know, just because Bush doesn't want to get somebody mad? And you know, I wish they would have a fight on it, but they won't. In the end, this bill will, this defense bill will pass. Now, here's the important thing that the caller got to, though. The caller said, you know, this gets complex because, you know, they thought they were going to run against the Democrats, saying the Democrats didn't support the troops, but now the Democrats are giving more money than Bush wants for the troops.
Yeah.
You know, how's it? Well, I'll tell you something. This is the painful, not secret anymore. It's the reality. The 2008 race is not about the war in Iraq. The surge has not worked. Iraq is a disaster. The surge was supposed to establish stable governance in Iraq, not, prevent roadside bombings.
Yeah.
It hasn't worked. But Iraq has moved to a secondary position. It's going to move to more of a secondary position. If you want to understand this, you have to read the global media. If you pick up the Financial Times, they talk about the recession in America. If you pick up a Canadian paper, they talk about the economic crisis in America. It's only U.S. media that sort of like dances around the edges of this because they're so invested with business coverage now that they can't do a serious story about business anymore.
Yeah.
But the fact is, if you looked at the Wall Street Journal on Friday and you look down, they have a little column of business news in the Wall Street Journal.
Mm-hmm.
And the first six items were hedge funds in trouble, mortgages in trouble, municipal bonds in trouble. I mean, it was just stunning, that the durable good orders were complicated by the fact that they have more production but less orders.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, people don't want to buy stuff. And Christmas sales were not as good as they were supposed to be. So bottom line is, we have an economy that is in trouble. How bad a trouble, we don't fully know. But I'll tell you this, the reality is the issue of 2008 is going to be the economy. It is the economy.
And that is an issue that traditionally plays well for the party out of power, and especially the Democrats when they're out of power.
It's almost a perfect storm for the Democrats. It does mean that I guarantee you the Bush administration will fake up some national security issues, particularly if Rudy Giuliani is a Republican nominee. They like Giuliani because he's very close to them on these issues. McCain is as well. So they'll fake up some national security issues. But frankly, if I'm reading this stuff right, and if I'm reading what people like Warren Buffett are doing, Warren Buffett just moved huge into the area of municipal bonds.
I saw that, yeah.
Why? Because municipalities, in a bad economic time, issue a lot of bonds.
Mm-hmm.
He's betting, Warren Buffett is betting on bad economic times.
Our guest, John Nichols, here on Media Matters on WILL AM 580. We have a couple callers who've been extremely patient, and one of them from Holland. So let's hope they stayed on the line with us.
Long-distance call.
I'll say, Utrecht, Holland, on line one. You're on the air with John Nichols.
Well, thanks.
Thank you for staying on the line.
No problem. It's an honor to be on this great show. Well, running up to the elections in 2004, a well-known history professor here called the prospect of George Bush winning again, and I quote, a disaster for America and for the whole world. Also on this show, Media Matters, was featured a couple of years ago, Mark Crispin Miller, discussing his book Fooled Again, how the right stole the 2004 election and while to steal the next one too, unless we stop them. Do you think Miller is right in his analysis that the 2004 election was stolen? And if you do, doesn't that make the outlook for the final elections this year very bleak, almost hopeless? Because the whole Democratic primary process seems futile, almost, given what they're up against, or what they seem to be up against. Well, thanks for your answer, and I'll listen off the internet.
Well, thank you very much, and I guess thank God for the internet.
Great question. And let me tell you, first off, the 2000 election was stolen. So the original sin of the Bush presidency is that he wasn't elected president. He lost the popular vote by more than 600,000 votes. He clearly lost the state of Florida, and that is enough to tip the electoral votes to Al Gore. So Al Gore was elected president in 2000. Unfortunately, it was stolen by a Supreme Court intervention that stopped a simple recount of the ballots. So we know that an election in America can be stolen. It has happened. There's no doubt of that. Now, 2004 is more complex. In Ohio, as Mark Crispin Miller and others detail, there was almost a complete breakdown of the political process. The machinery went bad. They had, you know, people waiting in line sometimes for 4, 5, 6, 7 hours to vote. It was a disastrous situation manipulated by a Bush campaign aide who was the Secretary of State and thus in charge of the elections in Ohio. And I think that what we can say about 2004 is that it is very possible that you had an election stolen or at least lost through negligence. A result lost through negligence. But the important thing about 2004 is that nationally, Bush did win a popular vote victory in 2004. And I think that we should not underestimate the supreme incompetence of John Kerry's campaign. It was a pretty lousy campaign. And so I think that going into 2008, we have to take all of that history and put it together. First and foremost, we still have a very dysfunctional electoral system in the U.S. It can be manipulated. It can be undermined. Certainly elections can be stolen. But if you win by a good margin, it gets harder. If this is a good Democratic year, that makes it harder. That's number one thing to keep in track. But also, Democrats are very, very conscious, and you hear this all over the place, of the problem that Kerry was as a candidate. He was too weak, too wimpy. He didn't fight back at the right time when they did the swift boat attacks on him. He didn't respond with nearly the aggressiveness that was needed. The fact is, that's one of the things that's benefited Hillary Clinton. Everyone thinks that Hillary Clinton will go for the jugular, that she will be visceral. And it's also something that, interestingly, I believe has harmed Obama, although Obama's running rather strong right now. Mm-hmm. There are many people who look at Obama and step back, fearing that he's a little too soft, a little too gentle, which is frankly what the country needs, but also what the Democratic Party fears. So I think those two factors are the answer to your question, that it is possible to steal an election. But if the Democrats nominate an aggressive candidate who is unwilling to give space, it's going to be much harder to do so. And frankly, I hate to tell you this painful reality, too. If Wall Street, the corporate class, and the media class is betting on the Democrat, as they might be with Hillary Clinton, she might well, you know, there might not be less of an instinct to manipulate the process.
Before we go back to the phone lines, John Nichols, I want to talk a little bit more about the Republican side, because, again, that's a wide-open race.
Really wide-open.
Really wide-open. At one point, Rudolph Giuliani was the lead in many of the polls and was considered the front runner until roughly, say, 4 to 5 weeks ago, 6 weeks ago. And his campaign seems to be running, the joke is, of course, on 9/11. But I think more importantly, it's running on just a general fear of Islam.
Well, yeah, I mean, there was a joke that, you know, Pat Robertson, who's a fundamentalist Christian, endorsed Rudy Giuliani, who is a three times married, abortion backing, gay rights backing.
No, the joke. You know the joke. The joke is in the Republican field, the only one who's monogamous is the Mormon.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. But here's the thing, that Pat Robertson endorsed Giuliani. I said, what could Pat Robertson possibly have in common with Rudy Giuliani? Well, the answer was they both want to go kill Arabs. You know, and it's not a joke. You know, it sounds like a joke at the surface, but there's the truth. They both have.
Well, you saw Giuliani's response to the Bhutto assassination, which was basically, we need a president who's going to handle these people.
Yeah, just unbelievable. So the fact is, Giuliani was ahead, but frankly, he's not doing badly because of that. That's not what slowed him down.
Mm-hmm.
The fact for Giuliani is that this fundamentalist, this religious fundamentalist thing is real. And while Robertson may have backed Giuliani, the fact is the core fundamentalists do not. In fact, I was listening to Christian radio in Iowa the other day, and I was blown away. They were going on and on about how Giuliani didn't believe that, you know, Jonah was in the whale. And, I mean, they were blunt about this, that he's a non-believer in their view, and they were banging on him. So he has a fundamentalist problem, because that's a core base within the party. He also has another problem that's been very underreported in the media. He had a huge health scare right before Christmas.
Yeah.
His plane was turned around. He was taken to a hospital. They were doing CAT scans, all sorts of brain work on him. They clearly thought that he had had a stroke or some other aneurysm, something going on. It does not appear that that was the case, but something serious happened, and that pulled him off the trail. He has frankly been a very light campaigner in this critical period of these final weeks, and I think the Giuliani campaign is betting on an interesting calculus. They're figuring he's going to lose Iowa. They're figuring he's going to lose New Hampshire. They hope he doesn't do too bad, you know, and then they're figuring he'll probably lose South Carolina, may even lose Nevada, but they're thinking that if Huckabee wins Iowa, maybe McCain wins New Hampshire, Huckabee wins out in South Carolina, maybe Romney wins Nevada because of the large Muslim or Mormon population. Yeah, there you go. You know, and so, but the thing, so it's all divided up, and then their theory is that you get to February 5th, there's no front runner, and then Giuliani, who has a huge amount of money, and in these big states like California and New York, sort of sweeps through as the guy who sorts it all out. And that's clearly their bet. It's not something I've seen happen before.
Well, offhand, not knowing who the Democratic nominee is, just in terms of who would be have the most electoral success for the Republicans, who do you think their strongest candidate is if their goal purely is to hopefully win the presidential race in 2008?
If he can appear vibrant and strong, and if they can continue to spin the lie that the surge is working, it's John McCain. I mean, McCain has the foreign policy experience. He has the good story. He looks rock solid. And frankly, in a race against Hillary Clinton, who voted the same way he did on the war in Iraq, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
He would probably be the strongest candidate because he's very, actually, you know, it's just the reality. He's vetted. Everybody, you know what you're going to know about John McCain. There's no secret coming out. And he's charming, and he's pretty effective on the trail. I think he's their best bet, except that he is in his 70s, and that he's going to have to finesse that.
And I must say, it does show.
He's had health scares and stuff. But stepping back from that, then I think probably of the viable candidates, their best bet is Giuliani.
Our guest, John Nichols. We have one last caller who's been waiting patiently to speak with John Nichols today from wonderful Frymer, Illinois, one of our favorite cities down there, calling often. Line 4, you're on the air with John Nichols.
Oh, thanks a lot.
Thanks for waiting.
Yeah, I just really like your appearance on the Moyer show about the impeachment. It seems to me the Democrats could win so easily by just bringing up all the crimes of the Bush administration and the damage he's done in the world and the corporate corruption. It's just baffling to me. It's like they have a free ticket into the White House, and I'm just baffled that they don't expose the damage and the crimes. It's just baffling to me. So if you could talk about the state of the impeachment story, and also that one last thing you kind of overlooked, that an Ohio elected representative has decertified the voting machines in Ohio.
Yes, their Secretary of State. Yeah.
Okay. Oh, thanks a lot.
Yeah, no, that's a great.
Thank you very much.
Your points are really important, and that relates actually to the good caller from Holland. That one of the things is in 2006, one of the hidden stories of 2006 was that in states across the country, voting reformers were elected secretaries of state in Ohio, in California, in Minnesota. They beat incumbents and came in or took open seats and are really cleaning up the processes. So in a lot of places which had been electoral disaster zones, we are now seeing some real cleanup. That's one of the more hopeful signs. It actually is a rare moment where a citizen movement for voting reform and cleaning up our voting systems has had some impact. That's the number one thing. You ask about impeachment. You're absolutely right. You know, the horrible reality of the moment is that had Democrats moved when many of us hoped they would immediately after coming to power on presidential accountability, really getting into what Bush's high crimes and misdemeanors, and they are that, this party would be in dramatically better position. They would be positioned much as Democrats were in 1974 when they had these dramatic gains in the House and Senate. The American people do not punish an impeachment initiative. They do not punish an effort to hold a president to account. They reward it if it's done sincerely.
Yeah, but let me ask you one question about that, because, I mean, I think my sense has been that any effort to go in that direction, the immediate response of the mainstream news media and the punditocracy is going to be hostile.
It will be. It's our media.
So, I mean, the first wave of offense, like the troops landing at Normandy, is going to be, if you raise this and you're a Democrat, you're going to be slaughtered.
Yeah.
Maybe the people behind you are going to get through, but you're not.
It's a tough
and
thing.
And so I think, though, so in fairness to the Democratic politicians, they're saying, if I go on a Sunday morning show and raise this, I instantly get put by the mainstream media off in the total loony bin and segregated away as a kook.
It's reality. I mean, you know, when Tim Russert was trying to disqualify Dennis Kucinich from the debates, you know, they went with the UFO thing, but it's surprising they didn't go with impeachment. You know, because the bottom line is, but here's the problem. Here's the counter to that. Joe Biden, who was trying to revitalize his campaign, started talking about impeachment because it's the applause line.
Yeah,
the Democratic base loves this issue, and so it cuts both ways. But you're right about the media, and it's probably a good place to close here, or at least as we wind down. I was on a panel this summer with Carl Bernstein of Woodward and Bernstein, one of the great Watergate, Pulitzer Prize winning Watergate reporter, and he said to me, he knew about the book, and he said, you know, you're right about this impeachment stuff, and I like, you know, he's very, very complimentary, very nice guy, and he said, but it's not going to happen. And I said, well, why? What's the problem? Not disagreeing with him, but I wanted to hear what he had to say. And he said, well, it's not necessarily Congress. I know Pelosi took it off, but speakers always take it off because they're in the line of succession. But it's the media. He said, we have a different media today than we had in 1974. In 1974, there was no question that the broadcast networks were going to put these hearings by a congressional committee on live television day after day after day. And they did.
Mm-hmm.
Says today, they wouldn't, there would be real question about it, and if one of them did it, the others would counter-program.
Yeah.
So right off, the broadcast media is not going to do it. And cable now doesn't operate as a news operation, but as a common operation, so they aren't going to investigate and drive. And frankly, most newspapers have cut their Washington bureaus. So he went through this whole scenario, and he basically said the reason impeachment isn't where it should be is not just the Democratic Party or Congress. It is a fundamentally altered and less serious, less civic and democratic media.
John Nichols, on that point, I think that's a good time to wrap up. I hear the band tuning up in the background, which means they want to push me out of the studio. John Nichols has been our guest today here on Media Matters. I'm Bob McChesney, your host. I will be back in 167 hours with Sut Jolly from the Media Education Foundation, talking about media literacy and media education and the issues they're covering. John Nichols, thank you so much for joining us today.
Pure pleasure.
Robert Naiman, my producer, sitting in for Andrew Boyle. Thank you so much, Robert. And thank you all, great listeners. Have a great, happy New Year's. Drive safely and see you next week.
Mostly cloudy in today's forecast for Champaign, Urbana, and the area. The high around 38 and south winds up to 10 miles an hour. The low tonight around 25 degrees. A chance of rain or snow showers tomorrow. The high is expected to be around 37 and the low around 19 degrees. Winds from southwest up to 15 miles an hour. An Arctic cold front arrives on New Year's Day with a chance of snow and a high around 22 degrees, but wind chills can go into single digits. Northwesterly winds up to 25 miles an hour. This is WILL Urbana.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. The housing crisis, Don Imus, Michael Vick, the Pew Study, Iraq, and the presidential race, just some of the issues that dominated the headlines in 2007. Today we revisit some of those conversations.
When we think about the nooses, we have to think about it in the context of economic retrenchment.
Well, I've been praying for Brother Don Imus. He's returned now with two black folk, but constrained in terms of any xenophobic proclivities.
Obama really gets us into this cultural divide and how that's playing out.
Our regular commentators, Cornel West, Eddie Glaude, DeRoy Murdoch, and Angela Governor Blackwell of Policy Link, join us to offer their diverse views on the issues of 2007 and how they may shape our lives in 2008. It's a special year-in-review roundtable this hour of the Tavis Smiley Show from PRI after the news.